if the final chapter is it ever after. I remember waking up the neighbor like a stadium. Yeah, he ran upstairs screaming no one cared in the bad place.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. It's the 24th of January, 13 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock, and a great pleasure to have you with us on this day. Hopefully you had a beautiful weekend. Hopefully you had a very nice time, and we're back to the work week. We've got a lot to talk about today, and we welcome your participation. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Libby, was that you? It sounds like you just opened a Schlitz.
Sorry, yes. But not a Schlitz. You know me. Okay. I'm a teetotaler.
All right. Just a Coke free. Is that what it is? All right.
Coke Zero.
A Coke Zero. There you go. good morning. It's very nice to have you all with us. Let me introduce everybody. Alan Chartok, I see you through the glass. How are you?
Well.
All right.
Well. All right.
All right. Anything you want to share? We're
all
right.
No, it's okay? All good. It's all good.
All right. Okay,
it's all good.
Good. Yeah,
everything's good. I just had a wonderful report of our new WQQQ in, you know, down there in Sharon.
WQQQ.
Yes, WQQQ. You know, a lot of people wanted to have a Q in the name and everything, but I love that name, WQQQ. I don't know what it is, but I love that name.
It is, I believe, let me see, does it have, 103 QQQ.
Can you say that in radio voice?
103.3 WQQQ. Yes, I can. Well, that's very fun. And I hopefully we're hearing for people who are listening to it and are finding it.
Oh, absolutely.
Wonderful. And that was the whole point. So, it's really fun. All right, let's go to Libby Post, political consultant, our dear friend. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing fine. Very nice. Thank you. Also want to welcome UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies, Jennifer Burns, to the proceedings. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
Oh, good morning, everyone. Happy to be here.
Excellent. We are happy to have you here. And Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic, Sarah Rogerson, joins us. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you.
It's a little bit of hesitation, just like a little tiny bit of hesitation.
Yeah. I think it's built into like every greeting ever until it's not.
No, I think that's true. That's true. Like, how are you?
Yeah,
I'm fine. You know, given all this. I'm okay.
All of this. Yeah.
Right. All this stuff that you're dealing with, too. Well, thank you. Despite all that stuff, you are with us, and we thank you very much. All right, let's get to the topics at hand. Ukraine still making news, of course, and now we are hearing that the president is weighing what to do. We've been talking about this for most of last week, but now the administration is weighing deploying thousands of troops to Eastern Europe and the Baltics. The president is also considering deploying warships and aircraft to NATO allies in what would be a major shift from its restrained stance in Ukraine. So what we know is the move would signal a major pivot for the Biden administration, which up until recently was taking restrained stance on Ukraine out of fear of provoking Russia into invading. But as President Vladimir Putin has ramped up his threatening actions toward Ukraine and talks between American and Russian officials have failed to discourage him, the administration is now moving away from its do not provoke strategy. In a meeting on Saturday at Camp David, the president's retreat in Maryland, senior Pentagon officials presented Mr. Biden with several options that would shift American military assets much closer to Mr. Putin's doorstep. The administration officials say that the options include sending 1,000 to 5,000 troops to Eastern European countries, with the potential to increase that number tenfold if things deteriorate. Of course, everybody spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to talk publicly about internal deliberations. Mr. Biden is expected to make a decision as early as this week. He is weighing the buildup as Russia has escalated its menacing posture against Ukraine, including massing more than 100,000 troops and weaponry on the border and stationing Russian forces in Belarus. On Saturday, Britain accused Moscow of developing plans to install a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine. We'll get to Britain's role in all of this in a few minutes. But with that, we go to Alan. Good morning.
Good morning again, Joe. Look, we would have to be pretty smart to get inside Putin's head and to know what exactly his drop-dead place is in all of this. In other words, in the beginning, he was testing, no question. As we used to say with our kids, testing one, two, three. He was testing. Then came the point in all of this that somehow Joe Biden and the White House people decided politically this was untenable for them because he looked weak. It didn't look like he was standing up to Putin. And all of a sudden, there was this pivot, as you say, a shift. And we began to say, oh, no, Putin, you don't do this. And if you do this, we're going to keep adding things on that we are going to do to you. Now, I think that was the whole game with Putin from the very beginning. I think he thought if he could get away with it, he would. But now I think it looks dangerous for him. And if he does it, it leads to the possibility, the probability of some kind of a war. And that is something that Joe Biden obviously doesn't want to get into. On the other hand, he wants to be a successful president. And so there's a sort of weighing of one against the other. I do think he is relying on his Pentagon people to make the right moves so that Putin knows that he proceeds at his own danger. But who knows with Putin, because he's got an unhappy group of people in Russia. He wants to take their minds off of it, off of their problems. This is the old Cold War strategy, which, of course, Colonel Putin was such a part of. More than that, I can't say, because I don't know.
Jennifer Burns.
I'm still trying to wrap my brain around so much of this because there are so many threads. You know, thinking back, one, Putin has been using the Ukraine as a political football here for, a decade or more? And really sort of beefed this up more with Crimea and then also his engagement with Trump. And I can't quite find the lead exactly. But what I find super interesting is over the weekend, former President Trump was doing exactly what Alan said. He's saying that Biden is being too soft on Putin and Putin wouldn't be doing these things if Trump was still president. So he's already tried to circle this, you know, get this into the news cycle for his own behalf, for his own elections and what are coming up in 2022 in America. The other thing is, the United States is very domestically unstable. And many of the recent polls that have come out have said that many Americans, largely Trump's base, are pretty okay with how Putin is behaving. And so I think Putin is also counting on this instability in America to help him operate the way he is. The other thing is, Trump's attack on the Ukraine to try to get at Biden with the Hunter Biden information. So that's got me kind of in a little rabbit hole. How is Trump now footballing Ukraine to help himself in his next presidential run? And then I'm struggling so hard with the human aspect of what this can lead to and how clearly Putin does not care how many Russians die. Between COVID, which is ravaging parts of the country, if there's a military engagement, so many Russians are going to die on top of how many Ukrainians will die. So there's a lot happening in my brain around it, and I can't quite get it to settle because there's so many rabbit holes.
There are a lot of rabbit holes, without a doubt. Libby Post.
You know, there's a lot of saber rattling going on, that's for sure. And Putin wants to reimagine Russia in the either the Tsarist Russia expanse or the Soviet Union expanse. And this is one more way of him doing it. He's already, you know, this is something we know that he wants to do. I think Biden is between a rock and a hard place. He has to come out strong on this because
I think we lost Libby. But it was very dramatic.
It was. It was poignant.
Yes. Has to do this because...
And then, that.
And then it got very quiet. All right, Sarah, we'll let you respond, and we'll try to reconnect with Libby.
Yeah, I wish I could fill in the blanks for Libby. there is a time limitation on this, and this is the thing that's giving me a sense of calm about the whole thing and maybe some insight, which is I didn't realize this, but I learned over the weekend that the invasion can only happen while the ground is frozen, because otherwise then it's in the muddy season and the heavy machinery and equipment that they would use for the invasion won't work. And I don't know why that's entertaining. I guess it's the little things these days.
Yes,
but
right.
For me,
we got to do this before the mud comes in.
And there's a lot of history
there. Lord
willing,
and the creek don't rise.
That's right.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, I don't mean to make light of the history and sort of in the real lives involved here, but it gives the Biden administration sort of like a times, so it gives them cover, right? They can talk about joining our allies, strategic coalitions, and it's not like the rest of our coalition groups aren't stepping up too. So, you know, at the bare minimum, to maintain our standing at all in international political stages, we have to show up on the schoolyard to defend our friends against the bully. So that's one piece of it, is that Biden can say, we're doing this for a limited period of time until it gets muddy. And is like no longer a realistic possibility. I'm not a defender of the military-industrial complex, but sending troops and stationing them strategically is a legitimate form of international peacekeeping engagement that's not as expensive as bombs and human lives and civilian casualties, which we've seen more and more reports of the civilian casualties of our airstrikes coming out in the one story over the weekend. So in terms of a low investment, high reward, that's sort of the zone that we're in. And if he can delay, if we and our allies can strategically delay Putin's incursion in meaningful ways, it's also interesting that then we might, you know, then there might be a way to sort of like head off the worst case scenario. The other worst case scenarios involve sanctions, technological disruptions, and all things that actually hurt the people and not Putin. And I don't think that's something that the United States and our allies want to engage in either because of the human suffering. All told, we're looking at what's the human suffering involved when a dictator decides they need an ego boost. And I think the Biden strategy is a good one that makes sense for this stage of the conflict. I don't think it's actually risen to that yet, because Russia keeps saying they're not, we're not doing anything. We're just moving all of our risk pieces around the border, but nothing to see here.
Right.
The other thing is that British intelligence released some information too that was interesting. It was a couple weeks ago, but about sort of a Russian interest in changing over leadership. And it's interesting that the troops have moved closer to the capital. So if they're trying to do sort of like a soft, silent coup of some sort or shift in leadership to a leadership that's more friendly to Russia, that's something that this sort of strategic engagement can head off more easily by showing a show of force. And I think hopefully Libby's back because that's where the saber rattling comes into play, I think.
Libby, the last thing we heard from you, this is very important because, and then the line went dead. So you left us in a... Yes, very dramatic moment.
I tried to get back on. So, you know, I think it's important, but something that Sarah said to me jogged some other thoughts. The whole military-industrial complex. We're in an economic downturn. We're dealing with inflation. We're dealing with all that stuff. Can you hear me?
Yes.
No. Okay. The one way we usually get out of economic problems is to ramp up the military-industrial complex. It's sad, but true. And that also may be a factor into all of this. But we need to make sure that we have NATO on board. And that the British, you know, that it's very interesting. I mean, you know, Boris Johnson has his own set of problems because of garden parties and COVID, and they want to take the, you know, the attention away from that. And he's doing his own bit of saber rattling around this. But I think it's important for there to be a united Europe saying no to Putin, and with not only peacekeeping or military strength at the borders, making it very clear that they're going to protect Ukraine and that this shouldn't be. But the sanctions just can't be from the United States. The sanctions have to be from all the NATO allies as well as the United States. And Johnson's got to go after some of the Russian billionaires who, like in this country, have tried to impact their elections as well as our elections. So, you know, there's a lot of different moving parts here, clearly. And Putin, you know, there's a part of me that thinks he's just a schoolyard bully and punch him in the nose and he'll back off. So if there's enough of them ready to punch him in the nose, he might just do that.
We have 30
but
seconds.
But he does have empire building in his blood.
We will hold there. When we come back, we'll talk a little more about Britain. We'll talk a little bit more about the subject as a whole and include your letters as well. Panel@WAMC.org is the place to send those to. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll continue with our great group and get news from the BBC right after this.
You were never really mine.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It's the 24th of January, 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. Making up our panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson. We're talking about Ukraine, and we've all sort of touched on Britain and their action over the weekend. I want to get a little bit more into that. With a late-night announcement over the weekend about Russian meddling in Ukraine, the UK signaled its aim to be a player in Europe's security crisis. Britain seized the world's attention by accusing Vladimir Putin of plotting to install a pro-Russian leader in Ukraine, a dramatic late-night announcement that instantly thrust it onto the front lines of the most dangerous security crisis in Europe in decades. British officials say its release of sensitive intelligence was calculated to foil a potential plot and to send a message to Mr. Putin. They cast it as part of a concerted strategy to be a muscular player in Europe's showdown with Russia, a role that has played since It has played since Winston Churchill warned of an Iron Curtain after World War II. And yet Britain's moves also bear the imprint of a country eager to set itself apart 2 years after it left the European Union, when Secretary of State Antony Blinken landed in Kiev last week for talks about Russian troops massing on Ukraine's border. His plane taxied past a Royal Air Force C-17 cargo plane that had just finished unloading anti-tank weapons for the Ukrainian military. The UK is differentiating itself from Germany and France, and to some extent even the US, according to Malcolm Chambers, the Deputy Director General of the Royal United Service Institute, a think tank in London. All of this also comes as the Prime Minister is dealing with lots of problems at home. The cloak and dagger nature of the intelligence disclosure, which came in the midst of a roiling political scandal at home, raised a more cynical question whether some in the British government were simply eager to deflect attention from the problems that threaten to topple Prime Minister Boris Johnson. I believe in this country, Alan, we call that wag the dog.
Well, you know, Joe, I've been thinking about this a lot. It is not only Great Britain. It's everywhere. It's us. It's Putin himself. There's always the domestic versus, you know, you look at a scale, the domestic versus the, you know, the real politic or what's needed in terms of our international relationships. So you see, for example, Joe Biden and his team switching in terms of taking a much harder line. That has to be because what they're seeing in the polling and the rest of that here. I think the same thing is true in Great Britain. It deflects from the, so that you always have to balance the needs of international relations as if you were sitting in some ivory tower somewhere discussing it all, as opposed to, boy, we better get the heat off us somehow. So I think that's something for us to all keep our eyes on.
Libby?
Yeah, as I said before, this is going to be, we like to say sometimes on this show, a kabuki dance, right? Not that this is all going to be fake, but.
It's just because we like saying kabuki.
A lot of moving. What?
I said it's just because we enjoy saying kabuki, but go ahead.
Yeah, I know. But it is, there's going to be so many moving parts and people posturing. I mean, you know, Boris Johnson is a guy who postures. He's a populist. Putin is a guy who postures. He's a populist. Then you've got Germany and France and the rest of NATO, who don't necessarily have the best relationship right now with Great Britain. And they're all going to have to, you know, play nice in the sandbox together in order to stop this incursion and to stop any threat of real war, which, you know, could very well turn into a nuclear war. There's no two ways about it, and I don't want to be alarmist about this, but, you know, they all have the capability. Russia has the capability. We have the capability. So we just have to be very careful but very clear with Putin that there will be consequences. And the making everybody play in this, well, in the sandbox part of this is going to take an incredibly deft diplomatic hand.
Sarah Rogerson.
That's all.
That was a lot.
Yeah,
that's
well,
good.
Enter Secretary Blinken, who is going to be talking with European Union leaders who until recently had sort of been trying to stay out of this in a way. The European Union does have a political and economic agreement with Ukraine that was entered into relatively recently, relative to the establishment of the European Union. So, you know, we also have the dynamics of the European Union vis-a-vis Britain and Brexit and all of those political complications. And you have a lot at the top. The saddest part of all of this, for me, for many of us, I imagine, is that you have mostly white male leaders at the top of the conversation, you know, dominating the airwaves with their aggression. And it doesn't actually get to the fundamental underlying issues of the conflict. And then you have American statesmen from Texas, white and male, saying, well, if we don't impose sanctions, then, you know, bad things will happen. But the sanctions, again, as I said before, don't hurt the people at the top. It hurts the people who are trying to get to work and to school and to make sure they have energy to fuel their homes and keep warm in the dead of winter. So, you know, it's a how long would it take for those people to be able to express their frustration in a way that's meaningful to Putin, right? So these larger sanctions, I think, make a lot of sense in terms of the freezing of technological advances from flowing into the country. But again, Putin's going to get his hands on whatever technology he needs to live a comfortable, warm, toasty existence, right, full of all of his dreams of invasion and world conquest in where his palace, wherever he lives. And it's the everyday individual in Eastern Europe that's going to be negatively impacted. Moving forward, we need really steady leadership, diplomacy, and a cool head. And I'm just so thankful that we have a Biden administration as opposed to a Trump administration at the helm, because I don't even want to imagine what it would be like otherwise.
Alan?
Well, actually, that's exactly where I was going. The wild card in all of this, Sarah, I think, is the idea that Putin had made his comfort zone with the Russians. And that basically, if Trump was still the president of the United States, I don't think we would be in the same spot. I would think he would be saying to the Russians, "Come on in. Sure, we have no problem with this at all." At least he would shut up about it. So I think that the missing piece in our analysis here is what Trump was doing with the Russians, which we still don't know.
Jennifer Burns.
Well, Trump was...
Well, go ahead. Libby and then Jennifer. Go ahead, Libby.
I was just going to say that if Trump was president, he would just see this as another opportunity for a hotel.
Yeah.
Well, and Trump, going back to 2014-ish, 15-ish, back then he was saying that Putin's actions of expanding its borders and into Ukraine were smart. He was making public statements like that. Mm-hmm. So he was courting Putin, though Putin was really courting and tooling him, far back as that. And you have to remember that Trump also had that whole Ukrainian scandal with the kind of we'll send military support, but he delayed it to Ukraine early on, the quid pro quo with Zelensky back then. So I think Trump would be fine with what Putin is doing. That's where I'm going to stand.
No, I agree.
On that. He would be fine. And he's not really about protecting democratic ideals anywhere. Trump is about trying to establish an America that's much more like how Putin runs Russia, authoritarian. Yeah. So he would be fine with it. And this is also one of the reasons the Russians, I believe, pushed so hard against Hillary Clinton and getting involved in our election, was because Clinton knew and would have taken a very hard stance on Russia early on. She was saying that back when Trump was kind of flirting his ideas and talking nice about and to Putin and the Ukraine back then.
So far, from what I have read, and I haven't paid, I've tried to pay attention to it to see, but the only thing I have found is that Trump has been critical of Biden's comments that he made during the press conference and just sort of seized on that. But other than that, as to his overall plans and what he thinks about the situation in Ukraine, there wasn't really any great detail. But also, the right is blaming a lot of this aggression on Biden. And, of course, diplomats are saying that Trump's resistance to helping Ukraine and his approach to Russia may be more to the point. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those. We will move on to other subjects as well. We'll do all of that when we return. We welcome your letters, panel at wamc.org. We'll be right back.
sitting on a roller coaster, holding on for dear life. I know what it's worth.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A lot of letters on this topic. We will go to them and then we'll move on to other topics. Hi, panel, says Kathleen. I have many frustrations with the Biden administration, but what I say to myself every day is, thank God we don't have a sociopathic criminal in the White House making decisions for our country. Please, as part of the media, say this over and over on air as well. Well, that is not our role, but I think enough of our panelists have said just that over the last hour, so we'll go with that. We do go to Michael, who says, despite what he says, there is no doubt that if Trump were the president, the Russians would not have bothered testing the brakes on their tanks. They would have stopped at the border. We tend to wish we knew the whole story about Trump's relationship with Putin, but we do. Trump gets all his money from Russia. All Russian bankers are answerable to Putin and only to Putin. Trump can't offend Putin or his money goes away.
And it may even be worse than that, Joe. It may well be that somehow we have always thought that there may be some relationship between Trump and Putin, which is, to put it mildly, unhealthy.
Gina wants to know if anyone thinks Putin's assault on Ukraine could just be to make trouble for Biden in an effort to reinstall Trump. I think we were talking about that last week and we came up with it would be a fringe benefit, right? Let's see.
Yeah, I don't think people are paying as much attention. Typically people don't pay as much attention to affairs outside of domestic
right.
issues, especially in the middle of a pandemic. I really don't believe that the average middle of the road swing state voter is really pinning all of their ballot box decisions on what happens in Crimea.
Scott writes, has your panel recalled Trump's quote unquote secret meeting with Putin when as president he met privately with Putin? I wonder what they discussed. Mm-hmm. That from Scott. Harleen says the Republican Party has become the Russian Party. If Republicans take over Congress in the midterm election, Putin's counting on them being favorable to his taking over Ukraine. He is in a position to do just that. With over a billion Chinese on his doorstep, he's looking in the long term to a favorable relationship with the United States. Then we go to Susan. I feel that the majority of Republicans who are calling for Biden to get tough with Putin would, if Trump was president, be okay with Trump accepting any aggression on the part of Putin. It's like they would support him no matter what.
I think that's a great point.
Mm, it is.
Yep.
Russ writes, the panel does not take into account the hard facts of the Ukraine standoff. Russia currently enjoys ample foreign reserves, and plugging the gas pipelines would be a very convincing diplomatic gambit. Across Eastern Europe, the prospect of hundreds of thousands of homes without heat in February might well lead many NATO countries to consider security guarantees for Russia, and this would be the basis of the fully developed Russian bargaining position. That from Russ. We go, we go to Kevin, who says, agreed that Putin does not give a hoot about the welfare of his own people, but like most tyrants, he wants to do this at zero cost to himself. A protracted conflict with hundreds, if not thousands, of Russian soldiers coming home in body bags will change the situation at home for Putin. How much suffering will the Russian people endure for one man's ego and little, if nothing else? I don't know. Is that something he has to worry about, Alan?
We have to worry about it all, Joe. And, I don't know that I get the premise of the letter. Could you repeat
The premise of the letter is that basically that Putin would, if Russian troops start coming home in body bags, that Putin would suddenly change and become a different person. And I don't know if that...
Well, it's interesting. You know. It's interesting. He did get out of Afghanistan, right, Libs? I mean, when he had to, there is still some public opinion. It may not be what exists in the United States to drive a political party out of power, but it could mean a great deal in terms of how Putin expects to survive.
Libby?
I don't think Russians coming home in body bags would have any impact on Putin. I think he sees that as part of the spoils of war, as it were, good or bad. And that as long as he wins, that's all that matters. The other part of this is that public outcry, as we all know, in Russia is staunched at every turn. And so while the people might not like it, if he says this is what's going to happen, that's what's going to happen because he rules the place with an iron fist. And, you know, he's president for life now and all the rest of that. So I don't think the body bags would have that kind of impact on him.
I think I'm going to say, Libby, a great trepidation because you're so smart, is that I don't think you're right. I think a president of the Russian Federation, whatever you're going to call it now, is very aware of what public opinion can do to you. They've had protests there. They've had other problems. Who needs it? And if, as I say, he got out, they got out of Afghanistan when they had to. I think they will be very temperate about pushing their population too far.
Jennifer, any thoughts on this?
No.
Okay.
I'm pondering.
All right. Keep pondering. We go to Rob, who says Trump thinks Putin is his pal. Putin thinks Trump is his stooge. One of them is right. President Biden did the exact same thing, spoke with Putin with no press, no media notes, etc. Please play these both ways. I have to fact check that. I don't know that that's true, but okay. Alex says, good morning, panel. Something not being talked about with Russia and Ukraine is oil and its price. The higher the barrel goes, the better for Putin. The longer he can keep this going, the higher oil goes, the more money Putin and his friends make. On another side of things is the Afghanistan pullout. It seems more and more this was a recalibration of where troops will be needed, considering not only Ukraine, but Taiwan. I would think intelligence on these two areas being hotspots within the year were determined last year and played a major factor in picking up and leaving, allowing enough time to be able to reposition as needed without a scramble.
You know, Joe, we spend billions of dollars on our top people trying to figure out what's going on in the minds of Putin and everybody else. How much do we know? I mean, as I think Libby pointed out, I may be wrong, Trump did what he had to do to keep the American people away from his relationship with Putin. We know that. And I'm very concerned about whether our security people are on top of this.
David writes, Exxon, Mobil, Chevron, Valero are all receiving Russian oil. It is about the oil. Dana Rohrabacher, former Republican Congressman of California, Alan writes, was voted out of office because of his pro-Russia stand. Rohrabacher was at the January 6th riot in D.C. last year. He is still an advocate for the Kremlin and a Republican in good standing.
Yeah, it's all changing now. In the old days, it was the Democrats who were always being accused of being too close to the Russians. Now we are seeing that the Republicans have made their deals, and Trump made his deals. And those folks who are riding on Trump's coattails will not in any way risk alienating him by taking an anti-Russian position.
Let's see. Let's go to Vincent, who says Ukraine is only one part of Putin's strategy to upend the geopolitical order in his favor, meddling with elections the world over, sowing division and discord here and in Europe, cyber hacking and more are all part of a huge asymmetrical warfare strategy. That from Vincent. Then we go to Matthew. Biden is beset with the Pentagon drooling for war, they being happy to have the Afghan exit disaster behind them. Why not let Putin invade and make it his next occupation after Afghanistan years ago? How did that go? Writes Matt from Oneonta. Let's see. Good morning, panel. As I wrote last week, Putin is rattling his sword to jockey for power for his political image at home and abroad. Russia is dwarfed economically by China and the United States and can ill afford a war. The Russian stock market lost 14% of its value over the weekend. Biden's reaction is just right for this mercurial situation. That from Robert. Jonathan writes, oil and gas prices will increase, helping Putin, but the Russian stock market will go into free fall with the sanctions the West will put on it, and that will hurt Putin and the oligarchs. Time will tell.
Well, so the assumption then is, if time will tell, that Putin really will care about this and therefore not do his invasion, right?
Right. That seems to be the gist, right? Marty writes, Russia is 65% permafrost and is melting fast. Putin is losing territory and will need, unfortunately, his training limits him to the use of force, subterfuge, murder, and lies, not diplomacy. Suzanne says, don't underestimate the importance of sanctions. A through line during Trump was the Russians trying to get them ended. Good point. Linda says, we all know Putin is doing this for his own benefit. He wants Trump to get into office again. They're playing cat and mouse with Biden. By the way, I think President Biden is doing a great job, especially considering the internal alienation. I'm interested in what they mean by the internal alienation. I think I know. I mean, is that within the party, I assume? Right, Libby? Would you take that? Okay. I'll move on. We got a couple letters like this, to clarify that Gorbachev withdrew from Afghanistan, not Putin.
Right.
Well, we would have to check the facts on that, whether or not Putin was still in some kind of a important position there. So, yes and no.
Oh, well, yeah, he was in the KGB.
Certainly, he was colonel in the KGB.
Yeah, he wasn't the premier or, you know, whatever they're calling him.
No, that we knew. Yep.
Let's see. We go to two more letters and then we'll stop for news. Brian writes, is there any circumstance, anything that Russia does under which you would be in favor of a U.S. using direct military force against Russia? And if not, what would you do? Well, there's a big question. We'll let it hang out there, I think.
Yeah, I have an answer for that.
And all right.
That would be a violation of international standards regarding, you know, human life and dignity. That would be that should be our role, is standing up for international norms and rules of law about use of force against innocent civilians.
So what's your definition, Sarah, of standing up?
Everything from supporting Ukraine troops, providing them with munitions and technological advances for them to be a stronger, better army to stave off Russia, to actually sending troops in.
Yes, actually sending troops in.
When we're talking about genocide, that's where we draw the line.
All right, we'll pause there. We'll take a break, and we'll be back. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson make up our panel. Meanwhile, stand by for news. Waves on a sea. Bright Side is the name of the new album from the Lumineers, the music that we are playing on the roundtable this morning. You can see the playlist at the end of the show by going to wamc.org/roundtable, where we post the playlist for each day. Making up the panel this morning, Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Jennifer Burns, and Sarah Rogerson. And we continue with the program. Breaking news that happened while we were on the last half hour, the conservative-dominated Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to the consideration of race in college admissions, adding another blockbuster case to a term with abortion, guns, religion, and COVID-19 already on the agenda. The court said it will take up lawsuits claiming that Harvard, a private institution, and the University of North Carolina, a state school, discriminate against Asian American applicants. A decision against the schools could mean the end of affirmative action in the college admission process. So let's check in with our group this morning as we look at this this story. The court's most recent pronouncement was in 2016 in a 4-3 decision upholding the admissions program at the University of Texas against a challenge brought by a white woman. But the composition of the court has changed since then with the addition of three conservative justices who were appointed by then-President Donald Trump. Alan.
I'll put 25 cents on the table that I know where this one is going. And they're not going to say affirmative action is okay. That's who they are. They're reactionaries, and it's predictable.
Arguments are expected to take place in the fall. Lower courts rejected the challenges, citing more than 40 years of high court rulings that allow colleges and universities to consider race in admissions decisions. But the colleges and universities must do so in a narrowly tailored way to promote diversity. All right, Jennifer Burns, what do you make of this?
I agree with Alan that I think that they're going to go against it. At the same time, what I think is so is a piece people have to consider is that this Supreme Court is so very conservative, but they also use race in a way to act as if they're not being racist, right? So they're going to say, right, Asian Americans have been discriminated against. So in order to protect Asian Americans, you know, this is the mindset, then we need to get rid of affirmative action without people really understanding that one of the major issues with affirmative action has always been that minority groups or people of color compete, Asian Americans against largely competing with African Americans, Latinx community and others for a small percentage of those kind of racial admission spots so that the demographic on many universities sort of matches the demographic around the area or of the larger nation. So the Supreme Court is going to use this in a backward kind of way by saying, oh, right, Asian Americans have been discriminated against, so we're going to eliminate race, without really saying, well, one of the real problems with affirmative action was that you largely protected all the white spots the entire time by having minorities always competing against each other for that small piece of the pie to diversify campuses to begin with.
Sarah Rogerson.
Well, I think it's telling that Justice O'Connor, the late Justice O'Connor, wrote in the 2003 Supreme Court decision upholding racially discriminatory admissions policies at the University of Michigan that we expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary. So that was, we're coming up on the 25-year deadline for that, which would be 2028. But with the big push from a concerted effort from Republicans and conservatives to whitewash American primary education by trying to eliminate texts about the oppression, discrimination against Black people in America and slavery, as well as the whitewashing of the migration stories that exclude Black and brown people, with the increased polarization and criminalization of migrants. All of these things fit together to create a very stark agenda, which is actually a philosophical one that many of these justices, including Amy Coney Barrett, seem to latch onto, which is sort of Putin-esque in that it's nothing to see here. We've solved the problem of the problems of our past. We're a fully integrated society. People of all color are represented. We don't see color, and therefore any type of making space for others who aren't white is taking away from white people. It's a myth of reverse discrimination. And if it's embraced by our highest court, of course, they won't say it that way. They'll mask it in lots of academic language that makes it sound a lot more neutral than what it really is. But what it really, truly is eliminating any sort of historical acknowledgement of the horrors of our founding, which is largely white-dominated. We still live in a white-dominated society at the highest levels. If you just look at the composition of the court, we could make a lot of commentary around a case for integrating the Supreme Court itself. So I won't be surprised by an outcome in this case that overturns the last several decades of precedent with regard to, attempts by higher education institutions to place integration at the center of their agenda, which is all that this is. It's not excluding anyone. It's making space at the table. And people are uncomfortable by that, with that. And I think that the advances and gains by Black and brown people in leadership is increasingly making white America very uncomfortable, including intellectuals and elites at the highest levels of government. And the word liberal almost escaped my mouth. But honestly, the quote-unquote liberal wing of the Democratic Party is not that far off board on this one. It's definitely not an issue like abortion that rallies the ideologues. It's been a tough road this whole time, and it really shows the power of the lasting effect. Maybe not the power, but the lasting effect of the Trump presidency.
Well, and even a little
rooted,
bit before
again,
too, right?
In white supremacy.
Right, because this is still
the continued growth
of backlash to Barack Obama being elected president. Right, we've discussed this many times on the show, but once Obama was elected in 2008, right, we get the birther movement, all the blocking to the Supreme Court because he may diversify that. Right, that would have extended this diversity at the Supreme Court level. So that was blocked. The other thing is that continuing, as Sarah has pointed out, that continued struggle to maintain color blindness and now say, well, because there was one Black president out of, all of the rest of the, 43 presidents before them, over 200 and something years in America, that means we've really turned this corner into a post-racial society. And yet that is completely counter to everything we're watching happen in America now. And that argument is also what helped build Donald Trump and launch him into the presidency, that we were past race, but yet he used every dog whistle possible to, hide that race was really developing everywhere. And it was the fear by whites that Black people would really be starting to enter these positions. And in this case, I see the Asian American community being the football. That's what's, happening. And we've seen the anti-Asian hate grow in the pandemic. And so now the Supreme Court's going to look as if they're doing something great in this case. Oh, Asian Americans need to be protected, right? This was discriminatory towards them. And it's a very backhanded way to try to argue that, diversity and inclusion is actually happening in America. It's really anti-racist.
Libby Post.
Oh, there's not much more that I can say to all this other than I'm sure the folks on the Supreme Court look around and say, gee, we have a Latino, we have a Black man, we've got 1, 2, 3 women, so what's the problem? And, this notion of not seeing color, I heard that from some candidates this year even, and I was just astounded, some local candidates, and I was astounded to hear that. It's such a 1970s liberal perspective that some folks are still carrying around, and you can't not see color. You have to see color. You have to see sex. You have to see gender. You have to see sexual orientation. You have to see all of these things. But this Supreme Court, you know, is doing the bidding of American oligarchs. And they want this to be a white country. And I've said all along, this has always been about race, and it will continue to be. I think Jenner is right. You know, in 2008, when we elected Obama, we all took a collective sigh of relief, and many people thought that this would usher in a new era of racial harmony in the United States, and all it did was unleash the demons that are still with us from the Civil War and before, and slavery.
Well, and then even consider the, you know, Shelby County decision in 2013, right, a year after Obama's second election, and now where we are with voting rights and the filibuster issue, and how, you know, so these things are really still, I think we're at the start. We're not really in the middle yet of the backlash to the Obama presidency. We're really just at the start. It's still just unfolding.
Meanwhile, a House committee in Florida passed a bill which aims to ban discussions of sexual orientation and gender identity in schools. The bill would bar educators from talking about LGBTQ plus topics that are not, quote, age appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students. An identical bill has also been introduced in Florida's state Senate. According to a recent report from the Trevor Project, LGBTQ plus youth who learned about LGBTQ people or issues in school had 23% lower odds of reporting a suicide attempt in the last year than those who did not. The Florida House committee passed the bill seeking to ban discussions. The Parental Rights in Education Bill, also known as the Don't Say Gay Bill, passed in the House Education and Employment Committee, largely along party lines. This bill is about defending the most awesome responsibility a person can have, being a parent, said Florida State Representative Joe Harding, a Republican, who first introduced the bill. That job can only be given to you by above. Harding's bill, along with its companion bill introduced by the Florida State Senator Dennis Baxley, a Republican, would block teachers in Florida from talking about LGBTQ topics that are not age appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students. Oh, Libby.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. Give me a break. First of all, who's to say what's developmentally appropriate? There are trans kids coming out as trans at 5 and 6 years old. So who's to say what's developmentally appropriate? That's number one. Number two, the suicide issue is really a big factor in the LGBTQ community. And you know, these folks are just parroting the radical Christian right, what they have to say. They want us to disappear. They want us to disappear from everywhere. But this is no different than bills saying you can't teach about slavery because it might make white students feel uncomfortable. You know, it's like we are whitewashing our educational system in certain states, not in every state, but in certain states, so that the parents feel comfortable. Well, you know what? I'm a parent, okay? I'm a parent, and my kid learned about LGBT issues at a young age, 10, 11, 12, when we first got together. And he went on to co-found the Gay Straight Alliance in his high school. So, you know, is that what they're afraid of? This, and he's straight. Let me put it to you that way, okay? And he's a straight man. So, you know, do they think teaching about this is going back to that 1960s and 70s perspective that we're recruiting? We don't need to recruit. There are plenty of us. We just need to give the kids the opportunity to come out so that they don't end up killing themselves, because that is what's happening. It is an epidemic within LGBTQ youth. They get such bullying, negative messaging from parents, from their churches, that they think the only way to ease their pain is to end their life. And this kind of legislation plays right into that.
Part of my, I agree with you 100% on everything you just said. My question, though, is do you want these teachers, whether this bill passes or not, talking about these issues with the kids? Meaning if they harbor the same
right,
beliefs as the
it.
You know what I mean? So like is that good either?
But there has to be a curriculum and how
right.
to teach about it, right? And so if they stick to the curriculum, it should be judgment free. Look, there are plenty of teachers who have said things. I read the gay press, you know, I read it all the time. And there are incidences of teachers who have said negative things like, tell us about your parents' class. And Janie talks about mom and dad, and Phil talks about mom and dad. And then Sarah talks about mom and mom, and the teacher scoffs at it. And then Sarah goes home and says, Mommy and Mommy, the teacher said that you were sinners, right? And that teacher then gets reprimanded by their school district because the school district doesn't harbor that kind of hate, the leadership. So you're always going to have folks who do that, and you're going to see it everywhere. It's not just going to be down south. You're going to see it everywhere, but it's about leadership and inclusion and equity and making sure that the curriculum treats LGBT issues on the same way it treats everything else, as long as it's done well and equitably and inclusively.
I want others.
And not as a threat. I mean, you know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say I want others to weigh in, but a big part of this, you know, another provision of this bill, and the more I read about it, the more just heinous it becomes. But
yeah.
One of the bill's provisions would require educators and administrators to effectively out known LGBTQ students to their parents without their consent. So,
yeah.
I mean, you're adding to those issues already.
Right. I mean, and that we had a bill here, a bullying bill a few years ago that came close to passing, and it would have done just that. Because if a kid was bullied, the school would have had to tell the parents why they were being bullied, and the students may not be after their kids. And so the bill got stopped, thankfully. But it's like there's a Jew in the attic, okay, and you got to go get them because they need to go to the concentration camp. So parents, your kids are gay or trans, and you need to send them to reparative therapy, to conversion therapy. I mean, it's sick. It's absolutely sick. And it comes out of a radical Christian right perspective. And, folks, I'm saying radical Christian right. I am not making a blanket statement about Christians. I'm making a statement about a particular political entity within the Christian denomination, the folks that want this country to be white and straight and dominated by men, and women should be kept barefoot and pregnant.
Not to correct you, Libby, but in fairness, the bill said that this comes from above.
Yeah, well, you know, my above and their above are two distinctly different
places, yes.
right.
Sarah, your thoughts? I want to read a comment from Sam Ames, who is director of government affairs at the Trevor Project. This bill will erase young LGBTQ students across Florida, forcing many back into the closet by policing their identity and silencing important discussions about the issues they face. Sarah Rogerson.
Well, I guess I would say Jesus wept, right? Like,
yes.
This is the weaponization of a misinterpretation at best and a manipulation at worst of the gospel, the Bible, and biblical teaching. So it's disgusting. It's terrifying because it's coming from the state legislature, which the state
can set educational standards, right? I'm unclear. What's unclear to me is how much the governors, the executive can have sway through the Department of Education when legislation like this passes. But we don't have a favorable administration in Florida. We don't have, DeSantis isn't going to be like, now, Florida state legislature, you've gone too far this time. That's not going to happen. Yeah. And it's going to be our children.
Right.
And it's our children that suffer. I see it. I have a front row seat to that on the school board. And this is bad education. And unfortunately, it's great politics, because the narrative that Trump is touting whenever he gets a podium is that schools are manipulating your kids into becoming progressive. That's not what's happening. My kids have spouted progressive ideals way before anyone had a chance to influence them, when they were in their formative stages of language around inclusion and what it means to love your neighbor, which are real Christian values. And ask the kids, talk to the children, see what they're thinking. And I think what's happened is the Republican Party has done just that, and they don't like what they see. They're like, holy crap, give us two more generations and we are toast. So what do? They invade the school systems to try to manipulate our kids into believing their disgusting ideology in order to manipulate this country into a more conservative base.
I'm
frustrated.
I understand. Rightfully so. I want to hear from Jennifer Burns. We do have to take a break, so let's hold. And when we come back, we'll hear from Jennifer, and we'll finish up the roundtable panel portion of the program. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org. We'll get to your letters, panel@wamc.org, and we'll be right back right after news from the BBC.
And every song was out of key, and I was in the in-between, and you still all alone. And you wanna be a big shot, you wanna be the big man.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Libby Post, Sarah Rogerson, and we left it with Jennifer Burns, who will take over. We've been talking about the effort in Florida to a bill that is going through, which is the Don't Say Gay bill. Jennifer, your thoughts?
This makes me heartbroken. And I'm struggling. I struggle with so many things like this, because this is like a don't ask, don't tell type policy, but it's also just promoting hate and endangering the lives of children. At the same time, it's not just a whitewashing through, it's not just a whitewashing of homosexuality and the trans experience, and trying to completely silence and eradicate them from society. It's also, a larger American cultural norm. And it happens a lot in the Black community too. Dave Chappelle's comments, just a couple of months ago,
right,
that were so transphobic, received such a strong backlash, and they should have. And, I think about how our schools early on already manipulate our children. And even if you don't have a policy like this passed, right, the movement of bathrooms for trans children, right? Like, you think of that scene in the film Hidden Figures, right, where Kathryn Johnson has to run outside the building in the rain to find the bathroom three buildings over because society was racially segregated, right? This is a way, these bills are a way to establish that sort of spatial dynamic in the curriculum, but then also physically throughout our schools. And I guess what makes me so heartsick about it is that children who are born in trans or gay families, regardless of their own sexuality, when they enter school, right from the start,
they are told there's something wrong with their family. There's something wrong with the people who love them. And that, to me, is one of the worst parts of this brainwashing. And I have to stop there because my heart is racing, because it makes me so emotionally angry that no one see, or these politicians don't seem to see that that right there in and of itself is an act of child abuse. It's inhumane.
I think that's such a great point, and I think, you know, Libby, you brought this up too, is that the what does the child do, and they're immediately labeled as there's something wrong with them or they're different. And then, so what's the opposite to this? Because this is for political points, right? That's why this is being done. I think, mm-hmm. Sarah, you were the one who said that. But Libby, I mean, this is why this is being done. And to Jennifer's point, yes, but it's also you're abusing these children who it impacts. And arguably, I think it impacts probably all children in some way, shape, or form. So how do you take the politics out of that and raising children in a loving manner?
I'm not clear what the real question is here. How do we take politics out of raising our kids?
Well, basically, what's the answer to this particular issue? When you have a bill like this that goes through, I mean, what do you do? And how do you, minus taking your kids out of that school, which obviously may or may not be an option, but as it becomes a state rule, then what do you do?
Look, state law. Right. I was raised in a household where we were told and taught about racism and anti-Semitism. My father was pretty homophobic, but this was the 1960s and 70s. And so I was raised with that kind of consciousness. And it's up to parents to say to their kids, this isn't okay, and that everybody needs to be valued, and all families need to be valued, regardless of what some politician might be making your teacher say, right? Because that's what this is. It's some politician making your teacher, even if the teacher doesn't agree with it, say that these families are bad and immoral and whatever. You know, yeah, you could take your kids out of school. Yeah, we could start, you know, new charter schools or whatever. Not that I'm a big fan of those, nor am I a big fan of saying, you know, take your kids out of public higher ed, or not take your kids out of public education. It really starts with the families and the kids and the parents saying to the kids, it's okay, we won't be mad if you say to your teacher you're wrong and fight back on this, even if you get sent to the principal's office, because then they get to call the parents in and the parents do the same thing and say you're wrong. I had this situation in a local school district, and it was not pretty, but we ended up winning. And it wasn't a law coming down from on high, because New York isn't like that, but it was a really bad principal who was really homophobic. And, you know, ultimately, he left the district. So, you know, it's going to take the parents to say no to this, as well as the students. And it's going to take us to go to the ballot boxes in Florida and say no. You know, I can't imagine that the folks who live on the east coast of Florida are going to sit idly by for this, or some of the folks who live in Miami. I mean, there's a big gay community in Florida.
You can't imagine it, Libby? I can imagine it. I can imagine this kind of awful, disgusting prejudice. existing. And
I can imagine it being implemented, but I can't imagine some people sitting idly by and not saying anything.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if you're right.
I think you'll see pushback. Equality Florida, the LGBT advocacy group, will push back on this. You'll get pushback. The national groups will probably get involved because it has implications everywhere. You know, and it'll be made a cause célèbre, and rightly so. You know, the fight for LGBT rights is not over. Just like the fight for against racial discrimination isn't over, anti-Semitism isn't over. This country has taken a hard turn to the right, and we have to fight. I mean, there was, as an aside, there's an adoption agency in Idaho who won't let a Jewish couple adopt a kid because they're Jewish and they don't believe in Christ, and this is sanctioned by the state. So it's not just the LGBT community. In this case, in Florida, they're being targeted, the kids, but it's everywhere. And we have to remain vigilant. And I know how hard it is because we get really tired after a while.
We got a bunch of letters. Go ahead.
Oh, and you know, and the big movement to ban books in schools,
yes,
especially in the South, is also,
yeah,
you know, part of this larger movement here, because it's trying very hard to eliminate allyship between straight kids and LGBTQ kids, or, you know,
right,
the language is so complicated, but kids who come from LGBTQ families who may be straight or not, right? It's really trying to create a divisiveness between them. And that's an even larger problem, right? If you omit that there has been a history of things, if you omit that there has been allyship, if you omit that there's been progress made on these issues, if you omit how long people have been battling for equal rights and human rights, if they're the LGBT community and who their allies were, then, you know, you are setting back the movement that has already been trying to unfold.
We just have about a minute and a half, and I want to get to a couple of the letters that we've gotten on this. D writes, education needs an upgrade now with the virus here, a fixer, Band-Aid education. With the Republicans attempting to control the out of control, the children learn from the internet. They are organizing against the Republican liars with religious beliefs and educational mind control. The children are watching like never before and can learn about sexual orientation from their phones. It's too late to take those phones away. That from Dan. Got this from Roger, who said, I went to a Catholic high school in the early 60s and never once in any classes were gays or trans discussed. Sadly, our education on this happened amongst ourselves. Robert writes, my 16-year-old brother committed suicide on Christmas in 1979. He was bullied by his classmates and his father. He was searching for his sexual identity. All he got was hate. The so-called adult men in his life were scared religious idiots. I say tax all churches as corporate entities. They enslave women and sanction perversion and hate. And that comes to us from Robert. And time for, I think, one more. And we go to another Robert who says, Libby is correct. Children are the least judgmental and handle information on the level of those teaching them. If you want to remove the Christian influence over teaching history or science, let's begin a movement to require all churches. I guess I already read that. I apologize. We are out of time. My thanks to everyone who wrote in. My thanks to our group this morning. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Libby, Jennifer, Sarah, you're all wonderful. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll be back right after this.